You are listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on WRIR's Weekly Audio News Digest, we talk to Susan Barstow and Irene Carney of the Sabbat School and Tom Shields of the University of Richmond about an ongoing forum at the Sabbat School aimed at engaging community leaders in discussions about progressive education alternatives. And let's all go to the snack bar. John Heidel, the owner of the Goochland Drive-In, fills us in on the state of the drive-in theater on the 80th anniversary of outdoor movie viewing. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
A USB device obtained by local activists in November 2012, as first reported by Open Source RVA, has been returned to city officials. The flash drive, belonging to Police Captain Martin Harrison, contained confidential Richmond Police Department information, including addresses of officers' homes and data on narcotics operations, according to Richmond police officials. Richmond police filed a civil suit against activists Nathan Cox, a Virginia cop block, and Mo Karn of the Wingnut Anarchist Collective late last year, shortly after both organizations began publishing some information from the drive on the group's websites. A judge issued an injunction requiring that they remove the information. They are being tried in Richmond Circuit Court for posting this sensitive information online. Tom Roberts, a lawyer representing Karn and Cox, told a local newspaper that the anonymous individual who first found the flash drive returned it to police shortly after the February 25th court hearing on the matter. Roberts and Karn both have asserted that the person who had the device was not affiliated with either the Wingnut or Cop Block. A person identifying themselves as John Q. Public appeared on this program in November and indicated that he found the flash drive in a public area near Richmond Police Headquarters on Main Street. Public appeared here with Karn. Another attorney for Karn, Andrew Bodo, also appeared on the show shortly after their appearance. Richmond Police were invited to appear as well, but twice declined. Virginia Pearson Benjamin, general counsel for the RPD, declined to comment on whether the disappearance of the device is being investigated as a criminal matter, but investigators who attempted to question Open Source co-host Chris Stovey in March confirmed the criminal investigation. The civil suit, being handled by an outside attorney contracted by the city, already had cost taxpayers nearly $200,000 as of last month when Benjamin finally responded to an Open Source Freedom of Information request. The case continues with the next hearing on May 23rd.
Richmond civic activist Charles Poole is again attempting to call attention to a seemingly doomed section of the historic Kanawha Canal, slated to be altered and incorporated into a planned new amphitheater being constructed by Venture Richmond. In a letter sent this week to City Council, Poole is asking leaders to reconsider the plan and save the canal. The canal and the proposal to damage it to make way for the outdoor stage has gained international attention because of its historic significance. Writes Poole, if a canal bank is lowered as proposed, it would destroy a long-range plan of a canal boat trip to Maymont. Other cities would be envious of our canal, running through the heart of downtown Richmond that was promoted by George Washington at Mount Vernon. The Virginia Canals and the Navigation Society, a statewide organization devoted to the preservation of the state's historic canal system, also has advocated on behalf of the Kanawha Canal. Poole's letter also points out that City Council already has invested hundreds of thousands of city dollars into protecting a nearby section of the same canal as it builds the new Second Street connector. Look what's developing at First Fridays tonight. Students from VCU's 2013 Senior Class of Photography will showcase the very best of their work and senior thesis projects this evening at Art 6, located at 6 East Broad Street at Fushi and Broad. The show entitled From Looking Will Run Until May 27th.
The Dogtown Dance Theater in Manchester will be stepping out this weekend with its first annual Looking Forward concert. This dance presentation at the former Bainbridge Junior High Gym, which was renovated into a studio space in 2009, will feature new work by Ground Zero Dance Company artists such as Pam England and Amy Page, and by emerging choreographers from the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Dance and Choreography. There's one show tonight at 8 p.m. and two shows tomorrow at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. For more on the movement, including ticket information, go to groundzerodanceco.wordpress.com.
There's a lot about public education that a lot of people aren't entirely satisfied with these days. And not just in Richmond. Nationally, conversations are turning to whether the last decade and a half has been well spent, with its overemphasis on benchmark testing and its ubiquitous catchphrase, "No Child Left Behind." With 15 years of Virginia's own standards of learning tests behind us, and with the state in the midst of a major revision, it's probably time to do a little soul searching. And that's exactly what the Sabbat School at Stony Point is hoping the Richmond region, Virginia, and perhaps the nation is ready to do. The tiny school on Richmond's south side, student population not much more than 150 or so, is positioning itself to host what it hopes will be an ongoing conversation focused on progressive and creative solutions to our nation's struggle with how best to educate our kids. All right. I am with Susan Barstow. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
All right. She is the Director of Studies at Sabbat at Stony Point. Excuse me. Irene Carney, she's the Executive Director at Sabbat. And Tom Shields, who's the Board President at Sabbat and also a professor in the School of Professional and Continuing Studies at University of Richmond. Deep breath. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
All right. And so I guess what we're here to talk a little bit about is a very interesting effort by your school, which of course is a fairly tiny little school, to become something of a forum for educational conversation, larger, much broader educational conversation.
Right.
Why don't we start with Irene? Can you tell me a little bit about Sabbat and its history?
Sure. It has a three-part history, having started in 1966 when Stony Point School was founded by some parents and educators that wanted to provide another alternative south of the river. 6 years later, in 1972, a group of parents who lived in Sabbat, Manikin Sabbat, in Goochland County, started a preschool there. And then, exactly, at that time. And then eventually those two schools merged in 2007 to become Sabbat at Stony Point. And when we did, we had agreed that this new school was going to create a new paradigm for teaching and learning, and that that would emerge from, or it would build on the shoulders of the program in the preschool, which had followed a particular educational model or approach called the Reggio Emilia approach.
And this is out of Italy.
It is. Yeah, Reggio Emilia is a small town on the Reggio Parmigiana Plain.
I was going to say, there's got to be cheese involved somewhere.
Lots of cheese. Okay. but in the post-World War II era, that community decided that they were going to rebuild their town with attention to the youngest children. Hmm. And they created a network of centers and it's not simply the fact that the town has this wonderful complement of publicly funded early childhood programs. But they created a philosophy of education that really brought the thinking and the ideas and the theorizing of very young children forward in a really visible way.
Can you guys tell me a little bit about what, I guess, where you're expanding beyond your classroom walls here, it sounds like, to, again, try to create a forum for educational conversation?
Right, sure. As I mentioned, all three of the schools had a lot of parent involvement in their creation, parents and educators working together. But in 2007, at the time that Sabbat at Stony Point came into being, it just happened to coincide with a point when the conversation was really picking up volume in the United States and internationally about the fact that a number of things, the digital revolution, globalization, all of those forces were really calling for us to reexamine our assumptions about what education is and what it should be.
Here locally, I believe, as I recall, 07 was really when things kind of came to a head with city schools, Wilder kicking schools
right.
out of City Hall.
Right, right.
And a lot of conversations around, I guess, well, frankly, very frank conversations about the district not doing very well.
Right.
And then some interesting regional conversations, I think, that started that year
right.
about or restarted once again. And they've kind of cropped up again here more recently talking about how do we improve our schools at large rather than...
Exactly, right. And that conversation actually even having a national sort of focus to the extent that the international tests are constantly, continuously showing the United States being, you know, halfway back in the second tier.
But our tests show us doing so well.
Right. Yeah. That.
Was that loaded?
Especially
that
where our confidence is concerned. Right.
So,
yeah, exactly.
So we have the SOLs and other standardized
right.
tests that are showing us achieving it at relatively high levels
right.
until last year
right.
when they did a little edit to the math.
Right.
And
yeah.
supposedly that will happen again with the English in this coming year.
Right.
And then you're saying, too, and I guess we were talking a little bit before the broadcast
mm-hmm.
a little bit about this, is the idea that every child wins, we all win. And that's something that internationally is
right.
Well, not agreed with.
Well, one huge difference is that the international tests are critical thinking. So they're not fill-in-the-bubble tests. They're not multiple choice. The kids are given a problem with a certain amount of data. They have to think about how to apply the information that they have and how to fill in what they don't. And it's a way of assessing problem-solving, flexible thinking, you know, sort of adaptive thinking. And so while we're doing very well on these very focused, specific tests that test, you know, particular bits of information across those discipline areas, that's not what's being assessed. And the argument is that's not what we need any longer, you know, for preparing people for further learning or for the new economies. So the international tests are sort of forcing us to look at what are we missing in what we're teaching and in what we're assessing in
right.
our kids.
Well, who wants to tell me a little bit about this forum that you guys have created? And I don't.
Well,
Tom,
I'll talk a little about the forum, and then maybe Susan, you want to talk a little about the conference
Absolutely.
That we just held that was part of the forum that was part of that. We had a community forum that was part of a greater conference where we had educators from across the United States. That were there to talk about these different paradigms, these shifting paradigms that we are, you know, talking about at SABET and that we see are happening elsewhere. And so the forum that we had on the first evening of the conference was we had a good many people there in Founders Hall at SABET to talk about this new thought of an education revolution. What would we see, as Irene just outlined, what would education look like in the future, and what should it look like with these changing paradigms and globalization and the role of equity, and how should we think through this, particularly, as Irene mentioned, that where we've gotten to the point that we're mastering our standards of learning here in Virginia and other high-stakes tests across the United States, but that doesn't necessarily mean that good learning or good understanding or good discovery is happening in a classroom. Good depth of understanding, because what these international tests are examining, for instance, PISA is the one that's most known, is showing that we don't have that depth and understanding.
And now these tests, these international tests, as I understand how they're applied here, is they will basically give them as a sample to a sample group.
Yep, 15-year-olds.
And sort of almost like dipping the bucket into
mm-hmm.
the larger morass that is our education system to sort of get a good sample pot of data.
Yep, yep. And what is the PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment, PISA test is run out of what they call the OECD, which is out of Paris, the Organization of Economic and Community Development. And OECD was created after the Marshall Plan in the 1960s. And what the OECD has been historically was to judge which countries
are succeeding economically, and what do their economies look like, and what is their structure and their function, and what will they look like in the future, and are they healthy countries economically?
And I would think education would be kind of a leading indicator.
Well, so that's what they developed in the 2000s. There's been three iterations of this test now, is to show, okay, which countries are healthy economically, socioeconomically, and then what is the education? So it ties in those three areas. And out of the downturn in the economy, what there's various reports out of the OECD are showing is that those countries that had a strong equity and strong quality, those are the two measurements that they really look at, that those countries actually came out of the Great Recession much more stronger because of the equity and the quality. And what we're seeing here is that our best performers from the higher socioeconomic areas did well on the test, but there's great disparities economically. And so the community forum kind of condensed all that and talked about it in a way, opened it up for a lot of conversation. And I'll let Susan address some of the issues that were talked about in the conference around pedagogy and curriculum and teaching.
Now, of course, this is the first of these, too. This is not the last. This is the first conversation that you've had.
Right.
So go on, Susan. I'm sorry I interrupted you before you even got started.
That's fine. The community forum happened on the one-year anniversary of Rafe Esquith and Sir Ken Robinson coming and talking at the Richmond Forum about education. So in a sense, we feel it was a second conversation.
And these two guys, for those who don't know, I guess Rafe has some very – he's a teacher.
He's a teacher.
He's still a teacher, I think, in California.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Los Angeles.
And has some very interesting methods of teaching low-income students.
Public school students,
public
right.
Public school students, and has high level of success in the classroom that just it's – leaps and bounds above the rest of the school. And of course, Ken says funny things about education.
He does.
Makes us think.
He's the wittiest person talking about education today.
Wittiest guy in education.
And he's a big proponent of a lot of the things that are important to us at Sabot, creativity, problem solving, and inquiry based approach. And what was exciting at the Institute was that we brought together people from so many different schools. So we've been working on figuring out this approach ourselves in our tiny little school in tiny little Richmond.
Yeah, 183 students.
183 students, Chris.
Qualifies you to be the brain trust.
The revolution has to start somewhere.
It does.
So.
But we had people coming from urban areas, from rural areas. We had people from public schools. We had university professors. So it was a conversation that was able to come together with people from a lot of different educational contexts and think about how we can best approach teaching in this case, we are focused mostly on elementary school children and bringing this social constructivist approach to the fore. And I think what's really important about this and makes it stand out from different approaches in progressive schools is that it's collaborative. And I think that really speaks to the ways in which it's going to translate into people working in teams, people making discoveries together. Scientists don't work alone anymore. Doctors don't work alone. Writers don't even work alone anymore. So we're teaching the children at a really young age to work together and value one another's strengths. And it's hard work, but it's not as hard when you're 5 or 6 or 12 as it is to learn it as an adult.
So a lot of this is it's group work, but then it's having almost like a project leader is your teacher. And so you're creating sort of small project teams?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when we think of the a metaphor that Reggio Emilia uses is that the teacher is continually playing in sort of a tennis or ping pong game, continually hitting the ball back to the children and providing them with input or new questions or a new provocation so that the study can go deeper, become more complex, become more rich. We also consider ourselves learners along with the children, and I think that's a really important
It sounds like an exhaustive
distinction.
Way to teach.
It's both exhausting and incredibly thrilling, I think, probably in equal measure.
Yeah. So you guys really are probably the place, and I don't know if anybody else is using this model in Richmond right now. are they?
We have a colleague at another independent school who's been teaching in her grade level, you know, in this way for many, many years, and she's a wonderful sort of partner for us in our thinking. And
is
we're,
she in public education? Or
no, and in independent school at St.
Okay.
Catharines.
Okay.
So we provide a family for her, right? Okay. And she, you know, and she provides another sort of, she bounces the ball back to us as well, too.
But what you guys are and in fact, you're not really proposing anything. You're not saying this is the model for public education, or are
right.
you? Or is it more about let's have conversations around what is the best model? How do we apply this to a system with 2,600 kids that
right.
are all low income or predominantly low income?
Right.
I mean, I think,
And that's a question.
I think that's And I would answer it sort of both. It's sort of both ways. I mean, this is something that an approach that we passionately believe in. But there's no arrogance and no sense of, oh, we found the key to the mythologies, and there
sure.
isn't something that we can learn from everyone else. And we sure learned a lot from the people in the other conferences. But there are experiments out there with this approach. There's one on an Indian reservation out in Oklahoma, I think, a public school on a reservation, and they're using exactly this approach. It's a large school. It looks very different than it probably looks in a tiny school in Richmond, but that sort of inquiry-based approach with the collaborative piece on it, I think, is something that's transferable, but will look different, transplanted into different
Do you
schools
know if they're, what grade levels they're using it in?
They go up through middle school.
Middle school, okay. And this does work. You guys use it at the middle school level. That's your
yeah.
highest grade level?
Right. And we were talking in a meeting earlier today about a high school network called New Tech Network, I think, which is taking a problem-solving-based project orientation into the high school level, and I believe replicating their model mostly in urban high schools. But it's that language, it's that collaborative problem solving, real world authentic application of knowledge that is the sort of at the nexus of it. And whether it's this particular approach or, you know, another specific model, it's that orientation to the fact that we can't afford to waste any human talent or any human potential for helping us to solve the problems we have currently and the problems that we'll face as a human race.
Now, and in fact, it sounds like, to kind of, I guess, dissect this and maybe not dissect it, but go back about 1,000 feet up and
mm-hmm.
take a look at this, sort of what we're looking at, not necessarily is a particular style of teaching in the classroom, but stripping back some of how we're assessing, really, and what we're teaching. So in other words, you're talking a lot about the ability to think and to use knowledge to get new knowledge.
Right.
Which is not something that I guess the SOLs have a whole lot
right.
of stress
right.
in them to learn how
right.
to do.
Yeah.
Tom and I were talking a little bit about this as sort of, I guess, where our education system has gotten to today is something that is that. And I guess you started our conversation here a little bit about that. Is this, we're sort of at a dead end, which is exactly why this last year, school year, they changed up the math SOL.
Right.
Is because they recognize the dead end.
Right.
They have to kind of start over, reboot. So are you getting pretty good response from localities that are, and not necessarily from individuals coming in, but from the localities that are interested in participating in this conversation? Or what does that look like right now?
Yeah, I mean, and you guys can chime in, but we had Douglas County was at the conference, and Susan and Irene can follow up, but Douglas County is the third or second largest school division in Colorado, and they sent about seven or eight people.
So this is national. This
yeah,
is
so they were, and we had educational, you know, educators from across the United States here for this conference, and they were looking at it in terms of their elementary school. They had the director of elementary schools, and they had 48 elementary schools. They have something like 50,000 students. It's, you know, if you know Denver, it's the big suburban area in Denver, Highlands Ranch.
And some of our local leaders know Denver very well.
Yeah, they're there. Hopefully they're listening on the their podcasts, and they can go down there. But
it's interesting. We've already exported some of our ideas to them while we're out there looking
right.
for their ideas.
And I think that was what I found interesting. This large public school division that wants to implement some sort of a Reggio Emilia approach, right? Mm-hmm. That they were there taking copious notes. I mean, in lots of questions about what this, you know, what our school was doing.
Are you seeing any interest from the regional partners, the regional schools, public?
Yeah, we've had some conversations with some local thought leaders in public schools, and Irene's presented to some local public schools with the administration.
We won't ask you to divulge who they are. I don't know if they want.
Well,
to
you know, some you know, and for instance, for example, Chesterfield County has been at the forefront of this with their expeditionary learning, and Robius Middle School and Robius Elementary School, which is just down the road from where Sabot is on Huguenot Road. And they've been interested in, you know, and have Irene's presented to some of their highest administration on some of the things that we're doing. And we've been in touch with other school board members and other divisions. And so I think there's a slowly growing realization about where we need to go in education. As you mentioned, it's the other places have been dead ends for us, and we need to start thinking this through.
And I don't want to take a position on that. I don't know that, but it seems like there's a recognition by the General Assembly, by the State Board of Education, as they're going in and seeing what they can do to sort of readjust these tests to test in a different way, right?
Well, I'd let my counterparts address the notion of tests because we don't really believe in tests at Sabot. Or even homework to some extent. The kids love it.
Summer break.
And I don't know if you want to address that factor. Okay, yeah. But
well, assessment is huge.
Yeah.
Assessment is critical to understanding what children understand and what they already know and what they're ready to begin learning. And assessment ultimately drives what you're teaching, and it should.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are hoping that we systemically we'll be able to move away from is choosing an assessment and then fashioning curriculum and teaching
around
to respond to that assessment versus finding ways of assessing understanding and knowledge and thinking and so on that is responsive to a different paradigm where kids are working more on this kind of authentic problem-solving model. So Susan is currently chairing a committee of faculty members across the school who are sort of looking at what are the different ways that we're assessing now. One of the ways that we assess is simply, and you mentioned how exhausting this is for a teacher, you know, assessing learning when you are trying to understand whether children comprehend the nuances of a piece of historical fiction that they've read, and you're assessing it by having them create original musical motifs to represent characters or conflict in the story. Our fourth grade teacher did that a few years ago.
So their own little Peter and the Wolf, basically.
Right. What she came to see was that her kids understood much more of the story and of the character development and of the conflict and the themes in the book than she would have ever if they had just had to write a book report or, you know, sort of do a quiz.
Essentially a different way of testing what their
it's a different way of knowing what they know. It's a different way of observing, documenting, and reflecting on what do you see here about what they understand. Where are the discrepancies or where are the fallacies in their thinking that you need to go back in, you know, and sort of come at in a different way.
Well, I want to ask you, when is the next of these programs that's coming? And we, of course, had this one on the 18th of this past month.
Right.
Past month.
Right. The next is June 13th, and it's a slightly different focus. It's not so much on what occurs within the classroom or teaching paradigm, but it will be Paul Tough, who is the author of a book called How Children Succeed. And Mr. Tough was a New York Times journalist who, in the course of his investigative work, really seized upon some really interesting, compelling stories for him in education and child development, and so took some time off to research the book and to put together his understandings about what we now know about how adversity affects the developing brain, what we know about what we can do to ameliorate or remediate derailed development or gaps or delays in cognitive development in children. And the question of why we're not doing that. You know, we have a lot of information, and we've had it for decades, about the importance of early intervention. We've known for a very long time that a child who starts kindergarten without having been able to take advantage of the rapid brain growth of their first 5 years is never going to be on par, you know, with the child that had the language, the enriched experience, the ability to kind of live in a larger world and study a larger world. So we're really interested in having him bring that to us as a community, as Richmond City and Greater Richmond, to help us look at ourselves in terms of what we know about children, what do we have in place, what are the places where we know children and families are struggling and schools and programs are struggling, and how does this bit of information help us to sort of shake or redistribute our thinking about that somewhat. Then, as Tom was mentioning earlier, the book often speaks to parents because he talks about the fact that in our quest for educational achievement, we've lost sight of some of the things that are really the qualities that help children or individuals succeed in their lives. Curiosity, persistence, grit, zest, you know, the things that enable people to overcome adversity and to learn from things that are difficult for them.
We're not all blue ribbon.
We're
school.
Not right.
That's interesting. Well, and again, I've been with Susan Barstow. She's director of studies at Sabot at Stony Point. Irene Carney, who's the executive director at Sabot, and Tom Shields. He's the board president at Sabot, and also he's a professor in the School of Continuing Studies at University of Richmond. Again, I wanted to maybe continue by talking a little bit about this idea of testing. I mean, how do you assess what your kids know? I mean, what sort of testing are you doing, or is that the wrong word?
I think testing might be the wrong word. I mean, first of all, we have small classes, so it's quite easy to do formative assessments along the way for teachers to know what the children understand. I mean, our assessments often take the form of children representing their knowledge or taking a sort of metacognitive look at the process through which they learned, say, about shadows, or taking a look at the process by which they learned how water moves, or the process by which they learned the cycle of the seasons. And then they will often represent that knowledge that they've gained through art or dance or music or essays or stories, and they'll often cross modes and media and represent it in different ways. So there isn't a lot in the lower school, certainly, of formal assessment.
Sounds like, I mean, what you're almost asking the public education system to do, if you were to say, hey, you should embrace this, is, hey, we're taking away the net. Now, get on the trapeze and go, and hopefully.
Well, I mean, we are looking. You know, we're looking for certain competencies, and teachers become very adept at judging those competencies. So it isn't as if there's no data collection and no sort of matrices that we're following. So there's a literacy matrix, there are math matrices and benchmarks and things like that. So it is quantified in some sense. There are certain skills we're looking for, and those skills include not only numeracy, literacy, critical thinking, analysis, synthesis, things like that, but they also include perseverance, collaboration, grit, wonder, and awe.
And again, we were talking about this earlier. Grit is actually an educational term now.
It's a hot term.
Actually, there's an assessment. There's a grit scale.
There's an assessment for that.
Right. Yeah.
So the idea that they can overcome and continue to try, it's not even just overcoming it. It's the ability to, even with failure,
absolutely,
to continue trying to get to whatever their end destination is, or the piece of understanding that they're going for. And that's grit. They're measuring grit there.
And you're looking, again, at internal motivation. I mean, there's nothing more external than an end-of-the-year assessment. And what we want to do is sort of light that fire from within. We want or preserve it, because children are born with that innate curiosity and drive and motivation. While our standards are high and rigorous, they don't look familiar. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's the thing, is there doesn't look like there's that net there that the public education system testing.
But I think we're looking for a lot of the same skills. We just use different metrics by which to establish whether the children have attained those competencies or not.
And maybe, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how do you ask the public education system to say, hey, you don't need that net, trust me?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is that I think what becomes readily apparent when you see a teacher's biannual assessment report on a given child, that the teachers know each child incredibly well. They know them thoroughly. They know them in a sort of deeply personal and, in a comprehensive way in terms of this child is a learner and this child is a member of this class community. So there's no question that the teacher is paying attention, understanding, the child's development, tracking and representing that. The other thing that I'll say is that we do a measure using a standardized test just so that we can reassure ourselves as a school that in language, in reading, in writing, and in math, that our kids are mastering those very important academic foundational skills. So we do that to check ourselves. We do that so that we can communicate to our families that their parents, to the parents, that the kids are attaining along those lines.
So, of course, Virginia, before we had the modern SOLs, we had something like that. And I think it was just measuring reading and math and I think maybe science. I don't recall. But we did do measures like that.
Right.
And we didn't have this cross-the-board testing every 2 years or every 3 years or whatever it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So there is already something of a precedent for this.
Absolutely.
Clearly kids were educated back then.
All of education. And, until.
And then we've had this before. It's, you read John Dewey and you look at the progressive era back in the early 1900s, the progressive era of education was basically what's happening in some of these schools and these approaches, but also in a whole country called Finland. If you want it, this isn't, if you're this some tiny school with 180 students, this is a whole country is doing this. And oh, by the way, really kicking our butts on this test, and other countries are now starting to adapt to these processes in education. And countries such as Japan are changing their whole system of education to go more in terms of this depth, these critical thinking processes. This is when I talk about this and I'm like, it's just not, this isn't a small little, school or a small division. These are whole countries that are changing their philosophy of education. Singapore is another example on this,
Right.
And this is documented in books that are starting to emerge now, like Tufts books, but Tony Wagner's book, The Global Achievement Gap, has been getting a lot of play. And it's because, in these books, they're starting to document what these other countries are doing, and we can do this. So, to our public education friends, we've started to chat with about on this. You can do this. Unfortunately, though, because of a hierarchical top-down approach that doesn't allow any autonomy within classroom environments, doesn't allow trust in terms of teacher, and flexibility in terms of curriculum and pedagogy, they're stymied on this, and they're not able to practice their own their craft, and that's where. I think it's a problem.
What's so interesting, I guess, as we hit this place where we are right now, is that the SOLs and standardized testing in general, in fact, the name of the national movement was No Child Left Behind. The idea was to rescue subgroups, mm-hmm. to keep them from being left behind. So it's the groups like your, subgroups get all the way down into kids with special needs, kids in low-income families, homeless children, but then also African-American, Asian, Hispanic, white, of course. These are all subgroups, I guess. And what's interesting now is that some of the subgroups that we specifically were targeting with the SOLs and with No Child Left Behind are the ones now where we're finding we haven't really done what we meant to do, right?
Well, and actually, and if anyone's listening out there, when they want to take and
it's
go
in doubt, by the way,
I don't know. I'm throwing out some of these books, and we're throwing out these terms. But if you want to go start looking some of this up, there was a great article in the New York Times this past weekend by Sean Reardon out of Stanford called "No Rich Child Left Behind." And what Sean Reardon and some other researchers are starting to show is a huge rich-poor gap, a disparity in education.
And growing.
And growing. And based on socioeconomic, but based on a lot of people are thinking in terms of the education that's provided between poor children and rich children. And this isn't, based on, independent. This is, in public and across the spectrum.
And there's an array of reasons for this, too, obviously.
And it certainly wasn't the intent. I think we all agree that the intent of No Child Left Behind really was
to
leave no child behind. It's just not, that in the workings out of that and in maybe a sort of misguided way of measuring that, things would have gone awry.
And we were creating that kind of monolithic program at the very moment that the reason for it was disintegrating all around us because of just the change in information and knowledge and the exchange of it and globalization. So we invested billions of dollars in creating these programs and these tests to help kids achieve according to a completely outmoded model. And so, you know, we really have to recognize both of those things.
And so what's interesting here in Richmond, again, this is the district that ostensibly is one that, that No Child Left Behind and the SOLs are sort of geared to try and help and to fix. In Richmond, and this was, what was after January with the new school board, we had a school board member, Glenn Sturtevant, who has suggested publicly that it might be a good idea to boycott the SOLs because of where they have not done right by the students that they, Richmond Public Schools, mm-hmm. is trying to educate mm-hmm. to get above where they are right now, which is in a tough spot, 80% right. low income, free and reduced lunch.
Right.
And I mean, just the idea that I guess a school board member in one of these districts is saying, hey, we need to maybe.
Well, and this is happening across the United States. I mean, Texas was leading the charge into the standardized testing movement, and now they're exiting pretty quickly from that. And it's happening in their state legislature this past cycle, and it's they've reduced their number of tests from 15 to 5. They've had 600 boards of education down there vote to not have standardized testing, and you're seeing this up in in Seattle, Washington, where teachers are basically marching out in mass saying we're not going to administer the test. You see something called an opt-out movement, where parents, and particularly wealthier parents, higher socioeconomic parents, are telling their schools, my child's not going to be in on testing day. And so this opt-out movement, there's a website, Diane Ravitch at New York University is pushing a lot of this. If you go to her blog, you'd get more information that you'd want on this. But and in more, even more recently, it's starting now to have backlashes. And another example is Arne Duncan is speaking at the AERA out in San Francisco.
And ERA, you know, is what?
It's a large
education research association.
Okay. You got a huge protest yesterday from, and it's even having here locally. In Midlothian High School, you see a group of parents that have gotten together. They formed a Facebook page. I was at a meeting last night, actually, and they're starting to meet monthly. There was a school board member there from Chesterfield County, and there's the movement is starting to grow in Chesterfield and Midlothian High School to opt out or to stop the standardized testing that's now been so pervasive in our education system.
And I wrote last year about a single elementary school girl in Richmond who, on her own, decided she was going to boycott them. And she did. She said, I'm not taking them. And there wasn't any consequence. If you mm-hmm. don't take them, mm-hmm. then you just didn't take them. And I guess my understanding is that at the high school level, there are barrier tests you have to take in order to graduate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And those are for diploma credit. But below that, they really are simply the state attempting to assess. And I don't think that a district probably, I'm sure that it's legislated that the districts have to
Well, it's funding. A lot of it is based on funding, and you would start, you know, I think there's some concerns. I think there's not as much concerns about legality as there is about resources and what you would lose if you stop, if you just didn't
opt
have.
Opt out, you just are not going to get a significant amount of state dollars.
I guess, yeah. But you know, I think what you're seeing here, I think with Savitt, is this notion of what education would look like with a child-centered education that was free of these, you know, high stakes testing environment. And yes, we're an independent school, but we're also a school that places a lot of emphasis, as you've heard today, you know, on what a child can do. And I think both Irene and Susan could tell you many stories of just the capabilities of what, you know, any child can do when they were in a learning environment that was nurturing and that was caring to their ability to think very deeply about things. And I think, you know, I think that's where we've gotten away from that type of teaching, unfortunately, And I think a lot of it's been due to the testing environment that where we see ourselves in.
And I think that's part of our way of wanting to engage at a more citywide or statewide level is if we can show, we believe, the power of children and the power of their thought, their understanding, their ideas, then perhaps that can be part of the argument for getting rid of these tests, which are so stifling. I know Ken Robinson quotes a study where it's hard to measure creativity, but they were measuring divergent thinking. So, mm-hmm. you know, different ways of using a paperclip, for example. And they had a rubric.
I remember this.
Do you remember this? Yeah, the rubric by which you're at a genius level for divergent thinking. And they tested kindergartners, and they had 98%
divergent
genius
thinking,
level.
Right.
And then as you go up each grade level, the number falls down. And you get to adults, and it's 10%.
Because you're told how to use the paperclip.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And so what can we do? Not even to create, but to preserve the creativity.
So how did you do on that? Wait, no answers? Hold on now. not genius level?
No, Chris. I'm a product of a much less rich educational system.
It was a paperclip to me. I felt terrible after he was done giving that example. So, oh, boy, I'm dumb. All right. Well, thank you guys again for being here to talk about this. It's Susan Barstow. She's director of studies at Sabot at Stony Point, and she knows how to use a paperclip. Irene Carney, executive director at Sabot, who probably knows a little bit more about how to use a paperclip. And Tom Shields, board president at Sabot, and also a professor in the School of Professional and Continuing Studies at University of Richmond, who will be showing us later how to use paperclips for all kinds of stuff.
I have no idea how to use a paperclip.
No, we're doomed. Thank you guys again. And again, this lastly is the next of these forums is in
June 13th, 7 p.m.
And
on
then
our
after
campus.
That, you're hopefully going to continue these on into many years.
Right.
All right. Or until things are fixed.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris, thanks so much.
Broadcasts of WRIR is made possible in part by Rostov's Coffee and Tea, 1618 West Main Street, now featuring home delivery everywhere in the city. Details on the web at rostovs.com. WRIR is sponsored by Secco Wine Bar, open every day from noon to midnight. Secco offers artisanal wines by the glass, craft beers, and house-made snacks, sandwiches, and small plates. 2933 West Carey Street at the corner of North Shepherd in Careytown.
Enjoy your evening to the fullest. How about some snowy, crisp, and crunchy popcorn? That's a fine way to relax. Just sit and munch contentedly while you enjoy the show. Bring enough popcorn back for the whole family. Everyone likes popcorn. And now Mom and Dad want a cup of good, satisfying coffee. That's the kind we serve, full of flavor and satisfaction.
It's really delicious, and we know you'll enjoy it, too. At our refreshment stand, you'll find these pizza pies, freshly baked to your order. Make sure you get yours.
This summer marks the anniversary of an American institution, the drive-in movie theater. It was 80 years ago that the first drive-in opened in New Jersey. And at one time, outdoor cinemas were plentiful across the country. In the late 50s, there were more than 5,000. That number has now dwindled to around 300, but in Virginia, the experience of watching movies under the stars never went out of fashion. While some states have lost all of their drive-ins, there are 9 of them still left in Virginia, most of them housed in the western part of the state. Richmond, once the host of a dozen drive-ins, currently boasts no outdoor screens. The closest drive-in is in Goochland County, just off the 64 exit for Haydensville, and a real rarity it is, too. The Goochland is the newest drive-in theater built in America, bucking national trends and enjoying considerable success in its location midway from Richmond to Charlottesville. Joining me today is John Heidel. He and his wife Christina built the Goochland in 2009 on 10 acres just off Old Fredericksburg Road, and the theater will have its official summer opening this weekend, screening the much-anticipated Iron Man 3. Hey, welcome, John.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Exciting times for the drive-in with the 80th anniversary and all. Have you purchased all the popcorn butter and hosed the playground down?
We have been ordering left and right. I think we are all set to go for the season, especially this weekend for Iron Man.
You didn't enter into this lightly, if I remember. You researched this industry for years, right? Before you got into it?
I was always a fan. And growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, when drive-ins were dwindling, my family would still go here and there. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. But as they went away, you start to yearn for those things mm-hmm. you grew up with as a child. And started looking into opening up a new drive-in. Mm-hmm. But there's no books anywhere on opening a drive-in. There's no class to take drive-ins 101.
Right.
So that started the process of learning the industry. Mm-hmm. Talking to some of the and I use this in the most respectful way, the old timers,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, drawing some knowledge from each one of them.
Yeah, and you were telling me that they have been surprisingly supportive. Other drive-ins from other communities coming in to help you.
It's almost like a fraternity. And I don't know if we're the young whippersnappers coming in mm-hmm. or not, but they were really supportive. Our opening weekend, we had drive-in owners from at least three different states come to help us out.
Wow.
Did not ask them. They didn't want any payment. They just wanted to help us succeed. And what other business would you have that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How big is your screen and how many cars can the Goochland accommodate?
The screen is 40 by 80, largest screen you'll find anywhere. We can accommodate officially 343,
right.
But on busy nights we've had as many as 386.
Mm-hmm.
We have some hills that lie just behind the drive-in that give you a nice bird's-eye view of the screen. Mm-hmm. And they're actually quite popular.
Tell me about the reaction so far from drive-in fans and from the community. I saw you had some incredible number of likes on Facebook. How many likes do you have?
We should hit 24,000 by the time people log on and check it out. It's been overwhelming. You know, you don't... when you started this process, we had a lot of naysayers saying it would never work. They went out of business for a reason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, I believed in the concept, and apparently a lot of other folks do too. So we've been quite fortunate.
What do you know now about running a drive-in theater that you didn't know before? What surprised you?
Well, I want to say I know everything now, but you never truly know everything. You know, it is a lot more work than I initially thought it would be. Not to say it doesn't get easier,
mm-hmm.
and not to say it isn't fun. It's a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to have a great staff, and it helps to have great patrons that are very generous with the word of mouth.
Right, right. And you're showing Iron Man 3 this weekend. It's your opening of your season. Are you going to be showing first run movies all year? Or is this a special thing?
We pretty much show first run movies, always current release movies. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we'll do a retro theme weekend or a retro theme night where we may show a Grease or Smoking the Bandit, something like mm-hmm. that. But typically expect the latest and greatest out of Hollywood.
The last couple of years, the number of drive-ins across the country has kind of stabilized. Actually, it was dwindling and then it stabilized. But we were talking earlier, and there's some new challenges facing the industry, right? For instance, Hollywood's phased out actual 35mm film and has gone digital. Is this going to put you or some of the other drive-ins out of business?
You will see a decline in independent theaters in general, not mm-hmm. just drive-ins, mm-hmm. but some of the small town two- or three-screen cinemas won't be able to make the transition. We've been fortunate. We have already converted to digital. So for the last month, we've been showing in digital and quite pleased with the results.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we had a bad picture with 35mm before,
right.
But the digital has brought sharper images, brighter colors, an incredible sound.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what your opinion was on the difference between film and digital as far as the image and the presentation.
You know, I grew up with analog, you know. Mm-hmm. I love vinyl records, you know, that kind of thing. But digital has its improvements, and we're embracing them. So mm-hmm. we're quite pleased with it, and we're glad we made the change when we did.
Well, one thing I've enjoyed when I've gone to the Goochland is that you play the old concession ads and the trailers and the vintage cartoons. Is that going to change now that you've gone digital?
We are in the process of converting some of those to the digital format needed to project them. Mm-hmm. So that will not go away. That's become a trademark at the Goochland. Folks really seem to enjoy that old school flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. It takes you back into the late 60s, early 70s with some of these authentic drive-in concession ads that came out at that time.
Right. And, yeah, it's part of the experience.
It lends to the authenticity. There's no doubt about it.
We have so many entertainment options available to us. Why do we still love going to the drive-in?
I think there's a couple of reasons. It's an experience. It's not just going to a cinema, showing up 5 minutes before and getting your seat. It's about camaraderie with friends and family. Mm-hmm. It's almost like tailgating mm-hmm. without the alcohol.
Right, right.
And it's an incredible value. Where mm-hmm. else can you see two movies for less than the cost of one at a traditional indoor cinema
mm-hmm.
or a modern-day indoor cinema?
Right. And y'all keep the prices pretty low. How much does it cost? What's the admission?
Well, 12 and up, it's $8.
Mm-hmm.
And kids 4 to 11, $3.50. And nothing in the snack bar is over $3.75.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you compare that to what folks are used to paying at mm-hmm. an indoor cinema, and you'll find that there's quite a savings involved and a great deal of value, too.
Mm-hmm.
And also with drive-ins, and not just the Goochland, but all of them, they tend to be family-run. So there's more of a personal touch, and as a result, they tend to have their own identity, and they have great service.
I guess we can end here. Do teenagers still try to sneak in by hiding in the trunk?
We've only seen that happen one time.
Oh, okay.
We've got a pretty good staff that's always got an eye out, but it was at the beginning of a night one time a couple of years back. We had, at that point, only 5 cars on the lot. The sun was still shining, and we see a teenager get out of her car, walk around to the trunk, open it up, and lets her friend out. And we just laughed and walked up to him and said, come on, you got to try harder than that. So it was all good, and we all had a good laugh out of it.
It's kind of a rite of passage, I guess. You got to, you know, at least try.
Yeah, everyone talks about it, you know, how what they did at drive-ins when they were kids mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. It's really gone from being what they used to call passion pits in the 50s
right.
to a family-oriented type of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, we tend to play more family-oriented movies.
Right. You have most of your success with the cartoons and the – you were telling me you earlier you did sort of an adult-themed night, a date night, and it was a little bit controversial. Right?
It was controversial. It was a great turnout. We last summer we did a Ted and Magic Mike double feature.
Oh, yeah.
And we billed it as a parents' night out. Ladies' night out kind of an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Had a great turnout, but we did get a little flack for, you know, walking away, for, at least for that weekend, from our family orientation.
Right.
But, I mean, we play all mainstream movies, so you'll see our movies occasionally, but we try not to play anything that's too risque. It's just it's not really our market.
Right, right.
But, you know, we're fans of movies, and we always try to play the best of what the studios come out with.
And you have a lot of things there other than the movie for people, right? You have a playground, and you have some other options, right?
Yeah, the playground is probably the biggest hit.
Yeah,
with
that's a really nice playground.
And it's really designed to, like they always were. We didn't invent the concept of drive-ins or even the playground at the drive-in, but it wears the kids out. You know, they can burn off that energy.
Mm-hmm.
And typically what they'll do is they'll fall asleep after the first movie, and then mom and dad can kick back and watch the second one.
Right.
So
right.
It's worked out pretty nice for everybody. They enjoy it.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking to John Heidel. He's the owner-operator of the Goochland Drive-In. It's the newest drive-in in America, and it's also the closest one to the metro Richmond area. For more information on the Goochland and its upcoming feature film schedule, you can go to GoochlandDriveInTheater.com. Is that right?
That's right. And check us out on Facebook.
John, thanks for coming on Open Source RVA. We'll see you at the movies.
Don, I appreciate it.
Every time I have a date, there's only one place to go. That's to the drive-in. It's such a groovy place to talk and maybe watch a show down at the drive-in.
forget about the plot. It'll do very well, but make sure you see enough so you're prepared to tell
about the drive-in. I love the drive-in.
Please remember to replace the speaker on the post when you leave the theater.
Time to leave you, time to stay tonight.
And that's a wrap. The end theme of another episode of Open Source RVA. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Don Harrison, Amy Daniel, and Scott Bass. Our producers are Gabby Scardust and Jay Westerman. Our news staff includes James Summers and Cameron Vigliano, and a cast of thousands. And the part of Mike McKenzie this week is played by an actual Mike. Say hi, Mike. See? Nothing gets done around here without Mike. Liked our show? Then we like you. Didn't like our show? We still love you. And we've got a little something for you. Just go to rvaopensource.com to download podcasts of this and all past episodes of Open Source RVA. Feel free also to click on our donate button. Also, don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for updates. This week's show, I give it 2 enthusiastic thumbs up. See you at the drive-in. We'll save the aisle seat for you. Wait a minute, there is no aisle seat. Anyway.
Tell me and I'll do it too.